documenting the crisis of our republic, waging war on the new world order. This is Govern America. Govern America.
From just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro-FM stations all across the country, streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2, this is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks, your host here for the next 3 hours as we once again document the crisis of our republic, the undermining of our national, state, and individual autonomy. Today is the 10th of September, 2016, and it's good to have you with us once again as we are experiencing some tremendous thunderstorms here in South Central Michigan. I've been watching them on the radar here, and I'm getting a little bit of an audio here. I don't know where that's coming. Well, here it is. Okay. Solving last-minute problems here as I start hearing things in my ear that I'm not supposed to hear. It's always a undesirable situation. Anyway, welcome to Govern America, ladies and gentlemen. It's getting more and more difficult to stay atop of all of the corruption that is coming out about Hillary Clinton all the time. And I'm going to spend a little time on some of that today. Not that you don't know that she's corrupt, but I think we still have to explore it because the mass media largely isn't. I mean, they are in some cases, but there's so much there that, man, you know, this woman would be an absolute train wreck. I don't know if the United States can survive 4 more years of Obama-Hillary. You know, not that Trump is perfect either. He's got plenty of problems too, but it's just astounding to me to imagine what this woman would do to our country. Anyway, I'm looking at an article here at MLive here locally, and this is something that everyone needs to be paying attention to in your own area. They're putting in trail systems here locally. They have been for quite some time. In many places, many parts of the country, they're turning old rail systems into trails. There's a Rails to Trails program, and you can look that up on the internet. We've talked about it many times. Well, at least, you know, a couple of times. I'm sure we've talked about it many times in the past. As I recall, once in a while, we'll come back to it. But I just happen to be going through some of the local news here, and I come across this from MLive.com. Trail system to extend 8/10 of a mile connecting downtown Jackson to Concord. They say Martin Luther King Equity Trail. How's that for a nice, politically correct, warm and fuzzy face that they're putting on your tyranny? Martin Luther King Equality Trail is extending 8/10 of a mile further, going north from Martin Luther King Jr. Recreation Center to downtown Jackson. The 12-foot-wide concrete pathway will run adjacent to Cooper Street. Currently, there is an 8-foot asphalt pathway from the King Center to Biddle Street and 5-foot concrete sidewalk from Biddle Street to Washington Avenue. Anyway, they're connecting towns. They said the project cost $437,399, with $300,000 coming from the National Resources Trust Fund here in Michigan, apparently a development grant. The remaining funds come from the city's major street funds. Why are they doing this, ladies and gentlemen? Am I against trails? Is it a bad thing to have trails? No, it's not a bad thing in and of itself. But the reason why they're putting these trails in is because they want to make it convenient to do away with automobiles. And that's what it's about. It's all about eliminating cars, encouraging people to bike, encouraging people to walk, encouraging people to use non-motorized transportation. That's what this is about. Agenda 21, ladies and gentlemen, or as it's called today, Agenda 2030. And so that's just one example of many examples you can cite on a daily basis that's happening in your local area. It's happening in mine. It's happening in yours. It's happening everywhere. We've seen a number of earthquakes happen. And in fact, we have not only earthquakes, it's remarkable. We now have flooding in Louisiana, Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, Arizona, Nevada, New Mexico, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and there may be others. Huge parts of the country have places underwater. And in true form, to the model of pressure from above, pressure from below, you know, of course, you got the Black Lives Matter out there, ladies and gentlemen. if you ever needed evidence that George Soros was behind this organization, I mean, we already know that anyway. But I mean, at least he's one of the funders. But anyway, Black Lives Matter staged a protest on a London airport runway. Now, this proves perfectly that, at least in my mind, that this is totally funded and owned by Soros and, you know, and other people like him, you know, who basically want to destroy America, transform it into a culturally devoid, really, system. Well, the word I'm looking for is really communist. He wants to completely overthrow the government, in my opinion. And that is my opinion. Anyway, here we see this report regarding Black Lives Matter shutting down a runway in London.
This morning, Black Lives Matter's protesters blocked runway, I believe, at City Airport, London's City Airport. That's not Heathrow, that's London City Airport.
It's not Gatwick, it's City Airport, out east of the city. This is very popular with the bankers and the business professionals that just want to get in and out. And that's why they targeted. Nine of protesters got on the tarmac. They're protesting climate change, which is interesting, saying that it is reasonably unfair on black people. It says black people are first to die, not the first to fly in this racist climate crisis.
There was something else at Heathrow, the big airport, BA.
They were all arrested, and by the way, they were back to normal. Okay. But now we have a problem with British Airways at both Heathrow and Gatwick. A computer glitch means that quite a number of flights are being cancelled. It has not been a good day to try and fly out of the UK today. A rough day, let's put it that way.
We recommend flying out of the UK.
Yes,
but it's not
been
easy thus far.
All right.
Let's get to American politics.
Okay, so we have this situation also with, I guess the only thing I want to say about the Black Lives Matter shutting down the airport, ladies and gentlemen, these people need to be arrested. They need to be dealt with harshly. I mean, in my opinion, I think they need to be charged as terrorists. I mean, this has gone on long enough with this Black Lives Matter bullcrap. These people are not bringing anybody together, and they're certainly not doing anything for black people. When white people or any other color turn on the TV and see these Black Lives Matter hoodlums burning cities down, do you think that that's going to do anything good for the image of black people in their mind? Is that going to do anything to bring black people up? No, of course not. It's not designed to, because the whole group is funded by white people, in particular one white person. So these people need to realize that they're being used as pawns, they're being used as stooges, and they're a bunch of idiots. And they're not helping black people. They're not helping anybody. And all they are is hired scumbags. So, anyway, I said earlier, we have flooding in several U.S. states right now. We have an earthquake. It happened in Oklahoma. U.S. Geological Survey researchers say they're upgrading the strength of an Oklahoma earthquake that struck over the weekend. And this is dated September 7th, so apparently it was last weekend. They're upgrading it to a 5.8 magnitude, making it the most powerful earthquake ever recorded in the state. Now, there was also another, I think 5.7 or 5.8, which took place off the coast of California, I believe this past week. or maybe it was a week ago, I don't know. Somewhere very recent, within days of this broadcast. I mean, I know there are many people that listen later on, but we've had a handful of earthquakes happen around the same area in Oklahoma as I looked at the U.S. Geological Survey map yesterday. We had a big thing happen here, and I thought we had an earthquake here because literally the house shook. We had something that I was in my bedroom at the time, and there was a big, loud bang. And it, like I say, it was loud enough that it shook the house. And I came out of the room, and my daughters came, and they said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I was just coming to see if you were okay." We were literally checking on each other. And I went down in the basement to see if anything was going on down there. Nothing. Went outside to see if anything was going on there. So I thought we had an earthquake here. I still to this moment don't know what the problem was. It sounded almost like something blew up. Like there was an explosion somewhere nearby. So I went to the U.S. Geological Survey map to actually check to see if there had been an earthquake in our area. And I didn't see anything on the map, but I did see this 5 point, I think at the time it was a 5.8, I guess. And like I say, another one off the coast of California. How much of this is related to the fracking is my point about this Oklahoma earthquake. Is there any way to know? Well, I think they're looking into that right now. But this is just yet another situation, ladies and gentlemen, where certain environmental issues, if they really are environmental issues, aren't being addressed because of the money involved. Anyway, moving along, as I said, several areas underwater right now. And what does Hillary do? What is her answer to the whole thing? But to exploit the victims and use this whole thing, exploit the people's tragedy and misery to push the global warming agenda.
Another threat to our country is climate change. 2015 was the hottest year on record, and the science is clear.
Science is real.
It's wreaking havoc on communities across America. Last week's hurricane was another reminder of the devastation that extreme weather can cause, and I send my...
Okay, first of all, she's going to send her thoughts and prayers. Yeah, like people need her thoughts and prayers. How about you make a donation, Hillary? How about you go down there and visit with the people like Trump did? How about you go down there and make a donation? Donate your dirty money that you make from the Hillary Clinton Foundation. Why don't you go down there and actually donate some of this cash that you're just rolling in to help the victims out? But no. She ain't going to do that. No way. That might actually indicate a shred of decency. A shred, I said. Now, how many times have you heard this tired argument? It's the hottest year, 2015, hottest year on record. Over and over and over, we've debunked this nonsense. First of all, they don't use satellite data. They use ground-based stations, which are notoriously inaccurate. These sensors are put in the cities where it's hotter than in any place else. Many of them are located in hotter parts of the city. It skews the data, yada, yada, yada. Okay? So she's lying again. And anyway, we'll go on.
Thoughts and prayers to everyone affected by Hermine. But this is not the last one that's going to hit Florida.
Okay, no, this is not the last one that's going to hit Florida. Yeah, because Florida is in a hurricane zone. That's why it won't be. She's right about that. It won't be the last one. But it has been the first one in 11 years, ladies and gentlemen. 11 years. We've had an 11-year lull in hurricane activity. This has been the first active season in 11 years. So what does that tell you about your climate change?
And what's happening in the climate? Nobody knows that better than folks right here in Tampa,
folks,
and in the broader region. Sea levels have been rising here about an inch per decade since the 1950s.
That's bullcrap. That is an absolute lie. In fact, I got a PDF file here that I'm looking at, which deals with sea level rise. The GRACE data shows sea level rise less than 7 inches per century. 7 inches per century. Less than 7 inches. Okay, they say the paper, and this is a paper they're citing with this, sea levels have risen over the past 9 years at a rate. Now get this. There's a study that was done which indicates that the actual sea level rise over the past 9 years, and this paper, this PDF is dated 2013, it was rising at 1.7 millimeters per year, equivalent to 6.7 inches per century. Now keep in mind, ladies and gentlemen, given that broad, and this is a small measurement of time, things change from decade to decade, from century to century. And so if it really is rising, I mean, something can happen. Things change. Patterns of the earth and of the climate change so slowly that taking such a small measurement is difficult to gauge for a longer period of time, if you get my drift. In other words, what I'm saying is, even though it's rising, according to this, 1.7 millimeters per year, which is almost immeasurable of itself, it doesn't mean it's going to continue to do that. It doesn't mean it's always done that. It doesn't mean it hasn't always done that. Do you see what I'm saying? They say that the paper corroborates the NOAA 2012 sea level budget, which finds sea levels have risen only 1.1 to 1.3 millimeters a year over the past 7 years, from 2005 to 2012. Less than 5 inches per century. Folks, you can't even hardly measure that. And this is post-industrial revolution, and this is why, as carbon dioxide has risen over this time, you know, at least that's what we're told. The point is, this whole thing is based on, they're lying to you. They're constantly lying to you because they're pushing an agenda. All right. She goes on with the usual fear-mongering.
At the rate we are going, by 2030, which is not that far away, $70 billion of coastal property in this state will be flooding at high tide. And whenever our infrastructure is threatened, so too is our homeland security. The next president will have to work with communities like Tampa's to prepare for future storms. When I'm in the Oval Office, I'm going to work with local leaders to make smart investments in infrastructure to help protect regions from flooding and other effects of climate change. I'm going to continue to work on the international and national level to try to turn the clock back, to stabilize and reduce emissions even more, to try to gain more time. But we're going to have to begin working immediately on mitigation and resilience and prevention as well.
Okay, so get set, ladies and gentlemen. If Hillary gets in there, which is looking like she will, I mean, even though Trump is ahead and won, he's narrowed the gap some, but they're dead even. You notice, by the way, we never have any elections that are not nail-biters anymore. You ever notice that? Why is it that every single election since 2000, at least, has been a close election? Is that because close elections are easier to rig? I think that might have something to do with it. How is it that nobody, we never have a runaway candidate? We never have a candidate that's just always ahead, stays ahead, and sails through, no problem. How is that possible anymore? I'll tell you what I think it is. I think the media is very able to control the numbers. I come back to the... I'm blanking today. We have information up on the website. I encourage you to go look at sweetliberty.org in the vote fraud section. Pandora's black box, did it really count your vote, is one thing that you need to look at. And there's some other things in that section. Voters News Service, that's what I was trying to think of. Now, they've renamed it, but it was revealed around the 2000 election, or election fiasco, if we want to put it that way, that Voters News Service was feeding the networks, all of the networks, all the major networks, CNN, or I mean NBC, ABC, CBS, they were feeding them all the numbers, the results, the election results for the candidates. And so Voters News Service fed them one result, and then they flip-flopped and fed them a different result. And then they all were referencing the Voters News Service. As I said, they changed their name since then because they got quite a lot of backlash. But in that section, there is an interview with a guy that was in Voters News Service, and she's kind of drilling him pretty good, and he gets pretty nervous. That interview is in there in a transcript form. I think it was Victoria Collier is the woman who did that. We've had her as a guest on the show in the past talking about this. But I encourage you to go read that, what she has written there, because it's very important, because it serves to put the lie to the notion that we have honest elections here. Now, I still do think that they need a certain number of votes either way to rig the election without it looking rigged. But I think it's very instructive to understand these things, ladies and gentlemen. And I think it also puts the lie to the notion that when we're focusing on these excursions around the world, and they talk about having Afghanistan have elections and Iraq have elections, and I just laugh and I say, you know, you're talking about having elections in a war zone, a destabilized part of the world, and we don't have honest elections here. It's insane. Anyway, moving along, she goes on to talk about Trump's position in all of this.
And what about Donald Trump? Well, he doesn't even believe in climate change. He says it's a hoax.
Well, I think that speaks pretty well of Donald Trump. If he believes it's a hoax, then good for him. Anyway, moving along, we have Bill Clinton up on stage. He was speaking at Homewood, Pennsylvania on Friday. And, you know, what does he do? He gets up there and starts bashing coal people and ridiculing coal people.
We all know how her opponent's done real well down in West Virginia and Eastern Kentucky, because the coal people don't like any of us anymore. They all voted for me. I won twice, and they did well. And they blame the president when the sun doesn't come up in the morning now.
Why wouldn't they blame the president, ladies and gentlemen? Do you remember what Obama's plan was?
Under my plan of a cap-and-trade system, electricity rates would necessarily skyrocket.
That's why they blame the president, Bill. Is because he deliberately put him out of business. And he continues to do so. And what would Hillary do if she got in there? Same thing. So this is the thing, folks. Trump's got problems. Trump's got issues. I get that. But we can't afford Hillary Clinton being in there. And we can't forget also that there is a big deal regarding Congress. 2/3 of Congress are up for grabs. this time around. So we need to be watching the congressional seats. And above all, we need to be watching our state and local elections as well. All right, moving along here. I've got so much stuff here. But you're welcome to call in if you want to chime in. 1-844-646-8376. That's 1-844-646-8376. We see also from Vox, they have a headline out. The U.S. and China just joined the Paris climate deal, making it harder for Donald Trump to scrap it. Well, and this article is actually from Grist. They say China and the U.S. really want you to know we're in it together on climate change. On Saturday, President Obama and Xi Jinping formally joined the Paris Climate Agreement in a joint event in China, giving the deal a boost from the two top polluters. Well, first of all, I want to address this notion that it would be difficult for Donald Trump to scrap it. First of all, they don't join anything without it being ratified. Congress, only Congress, has the power, and the Senate in particular, have the power to ratify this agreement. If this agreement isn't ratified, we haven't joined anything, ladies and gentlemen. So anybody trying to tell you that we joined it, they're either being dishonest or they don't know what they're talking about. They say the future of the climate agreement is something of a numbers game. 55 countries representing 55% of global, quote, greenhouse gas emissions must ratify it before the deal becomes official. China and the U.S. together represent 38% of global emissions. I'll come back on the other side of the break. We'll continue this, and we have a lot more stuff to get to. Stay with us. This is Govern America. The website is governamerica.com. That's governamerica.com. My email address, radio@governamerica.com. Please stay with us. We'll be back. All right, we're back. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. As we continue on here on this 10th of September, 2016, we see from grist.org, again, talking about this situation with Obama being over in China with Xi Jinping, his good communist buddy, giving a basically signing on to this climate change agreement from Paris. This is, by the way, this is a non-binding agreement. We talked about this in the past. Obama pushed for it to be a non-binding, for there to be a voluntary clause. And at the time, and I think what the plan is for them to push cities, states, local municipalities, local governments, counties to adhere to this voluntarily. And then by adhering to it voluntarily for towns and cities and boroughs and you name it, then they will make it mandatory that way. So if they can't get the Senate to ratify it, which so far they have not been able to do, they can force people into compliance through a voluntary agreement. Isn't that the way they do it anyway? I mean, think about the income tax. Here's a voluntary system for you. And yet, if they find out you don't pay, they find out you don't file, they'll be trying to send you to prison. At least they have many in the past. And some don't, and some get away with it. But many haven't. Many are in prison. Irwin Schiff recently died in prison. And I think they were making an example of him. But anyway, they say if all countries that said that they will ratify the deal. Okay, let me back up here. The future of the climate agreement is something of a numbers game. 55 countries representing 55% of the global greenhouse emissions must ratify it before the deal becomes official. China and the U.S. together represent 38% of global emissions. If all the countries that said they will ratify this deal this year do so, including Brazil, Japan, Argentina, and South Korea, then the agreement could be entered into force before year's end. And they go on to talk about, the sooner the Paris deal is official, the better. The thinking goes, it gives nations a head start on how they're going to meet their non-legally binding promises. Blah, 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 blah. And Donald Trump is promising to cancel the agreement. And they're saying that it would make all these countries, it gives a nation a head start on how they're going to meet their non-legally binding promises and makes Donald Trump's promises to cancel the agreement look foolish. Well, I don't think it would look foolish at all, except for one thing. If you are on a city council and you pass an ordinance, requiring, let's just say you ban cars. Or as I started the show with a story here locally about how they're building trails. Okay, this is something local that's being done. Now, that's nothing inherently wrong with trails. But you got to keep in mind why they're doing it. They're pushing the trails to get the infrastructure in place so that automobiles can be easily phased out, or at least significantly curtailed. I don't really think they'll ever fully be phased out. I think they're going to be very expensive, and most people will voluntarily choose not to use them because they can't afford them. So voluntarily choose not to, voluntarily because of their own reality, which essentially is voluntary isn't voluntary, is it? If you're forced into doing something because of financial or a lack of financial resources. This is the same thing I think they're going to do with air conditioning. And we got some information about that. Speaking of air conditioning, let's just go ahead and jump to that. Keep in mind, here we got Kerry. Let's just go to this. This is the White House U.S.-China climate change cooperation outcomes. This is dated September 3rd, so all fresh stuff, ladies and gentlemen. They say President Obama and President Xi Jinping have forged a historic partnership between the United States and China to lead in combating climate change. From the Sunny Lands meeting in 2013 to the landmark November 2014 joint announcement on climate change and the September 2015 and March 2016 joint presidential statements on climate change, leadership by the United States and China has galvanized global action to build a green, low-carbon, climate-resilient world and was a major contributor to achieving the historic Paris Agreement. Climate change has formed a central pillar of the bilateral relationship between the two countries. Both sides are committed to implementing the three presidential joint statements on climate change and will continue to deepen and broaden bilateral climate change cooperation, building on the concrete progress and productive outcomes achieved thus far. Today, the United States and China deposited with the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon their respective instruments to join the Paris Agreement, marking a significant contribution toward the early entry into force of the Paris Agreement. The two presidents call on other parties of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change to join the Paris Agreement as early as possible, with the expectation of the Paris Agreement's entry into force this year. The presidents further express their continued commitment to work together and with others to promote the full implementation of the Paris Agreement. The United States and China will formulate and publish their respective strategies for mid-century low greenhouse gas emission development. The U.S. will release its strategy in 2016. And what will that entail, is my question. What will the U.S.'s strategy be? We already know that Obama is actively putting coal-fired power plants out of business. And now we got Bill Clinton, as I just played before the break, ridiculing the coal people, ladies and gentlemen, as they're putting the coal people out of work. He's up there ridiculing them, making fun of them, mocking them. Dirtbag. The United States will release its strategy in 2016, and China will do so as early as possible. The two countries agree to hold a series of technical exchanges on the formulation of such strategies beginning this year. The U.S. and China are committed to working bilaterally and with other countries to advance the post-Paris negotiation process and to achieve successful outcomes this year in related to multilateral foray. The United States and China commit to work together and with others to reach agreement this year on the ambitious and comprehensive HFC amendment to the Montreal Protocol, including an early first reduction step, an early freeze date, I'm sure, no pun intended, for Article 2 and Article 5 parties, respectively, and an ambitious phase-down schedule with increased and adequate financial support from Article 2. Why am I laughing or mockingly laughing? HFC, we're talking about hydrofluorocarbons. Listeners, these are used as an alternative to chlorofluorocarbons in foam production, refrigeration, and other processes. And we have to keep in mind what Kerry said recently regarding air conditioning.
Yesterday, I met in Washington with 45 nations, defense ministers and foreign ministers, as we were working together on the challenge of Daesh, ISIL, and terrorism. It's hard for some people to grasp it, but what you are doing here right now is of equal importance because it has the ability to literally save life on the planet itself.
So, if you use your air conditioning, you might be a terrorist, ladies and gentlemen. He said that in Vienna this past July. You know, that is unless you're, of course, you're John Kerry or Al Gore or some other elite. Then it's okay. And it wasn't the first time Kerry compared climate with terrorism, by the way. Here he is at the Atlantic Council.
And measured against the array of global threats that we face today, and there are many, terrorism, extremism, epidemics, poverty, nuclear proliferation, all challenges that respect no borders. Climate change belongs on that very same list.
They love challenges that respect no borders, don't they? I mean, isn't that right up their alley? Any challenge that respects no borders is a perfect opportunity for them to tear down borders.
It is indeed one of the biggest threats facing our planet today. And even top military personnel have designated it as a security threat to not just the United States, but the world.
We're all gonna die. We're all gonna die. It's the one sure thing on which every living thing can rely. We're all gonna die. We're all gonna die. Everyone so far has died too. There's not a thing that you can do, and you and me and us, we're all gonna die.
That's it, ladies and gentlemen. So you better get ready. You know, the rising sea levels, the planet getting hotter. We're all gonna die. Now, you got to keep in mind also the words of Maurice Strong at the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development in Rio, 1992. His quote was, "It is clear," and by the way, we have this up on our website, "it is clear that current lifestyles and consumption patterns of the affluent middle class involving high meat intake, consumption of large amounts of frozen and convenience foods, use of fossil fuels, appliances, home and workplace air conditioning, and suburban housing are not sustainable. A shift is necessary toward lifestyles less geared to environmentally damaging consumption patterns." So there you have it. They're implementing it, ladies and gentlemen. It's many, many years down the road since he said that. Many, many years. Took them a long time. But here we are. Now, getting back to this White House document. The United States... okay, let's go here. The two sides welcomed the decision of the ICAO Council to forward the ICAO Assembly its recommended resolution on a global market-based measure to address carbon emissions from international aviation. Recognizing, and you think it's expensive to fly now? Wait until this mechanism is put into place, is what I want to add to this. Anyway, they say recognizing the important role of international aviation in addressing climate change, the United States and China support the ICAO Assembly to reach consensus on a global market-based measure this October and expect to be early participants in such measure. They talk about the U.S.-China Climate Change Working Group, or the CCWG. They celebrate the achievements of the U.S.-China Climate Change Working Group and the U.S.-China Clean Energy Research Center, the CERC. Now, I'll bet you didn't even know these partnerships existed, did you, listeners? But they're celebrating the achievements in recent years and commit to further enhanced bilateral cooperation on climate change under these and other frameworks. They welcome the success of the U.S.-China Climate Smart Low Carbon Cities Summits, listeners. So, you remember when we had leaders from our states meeting with the leaders, provincial leaders in China? Apparently, we're going to have more hobnobbing on different levels. I don't know if this is going to be a provincial situation. They don't seem to indicate that here. But we are going to be evidently be having our leaders. Well, let's just see what they say. They say what they welcome the success of the U.S.-China Climate Smart / Low Carbon Cities Summits in 2015 and 2016. So this is something that's already happened and continues to happen, and look forward to the next summit, they say, to be held in Boston in the United States in 2017. How many of you even knew this was going on? I didn't. I mean, I figured they were on certain levels. They're constantly having meetings. And again, I have to plug the IISD.ca website. IISD.ca. I took a trip over there just a moment ago and found this. Second session of the preparatory committee established by the United Nations General Assembly Resolution 69-292, quote, development of an internationally legally binding instrument under the United Nations Convention of the Law of the Sea on the conservation and sustainable use of marine biological diversity of areas beyond national jurisdiction. The United Nations wants the oceans bad. The United Nations, there's a lot of wealth in the oceans, listeners. A lot of wealth in the oceans. A lot of minerals in the oceans. Control of the world is what it's all about. They say on Friday, 9 September, delegates, which is just yesterday, listeners, delegates to the second session of the preparatory committee, PrepCom 2, on the elements of a draft text of an internationally legally binding instrument, ILBI. And this is part of the reason why I don't read these on the air very much, because they use a lot of abbreviations, which can lose the listeners. But the International Legally Binding Instrument under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea on the conservation and sustainable use of marine biodiversity of areas beyond national jurisdiction. All of that met in an informal working group on cross-cutting issues facilitated by Chair Charles in the morning. They discussed state responsibility, liability, dispute resolution, and transitional application. Plenary met for the rest of the day to consider written, revised lists of points of possible areas of convergence and areas for further discussion on marine genetic resources, including questions on benefit sharing. area-based management tools, including marine protected areas, environmental impact assessments, and capacity building and technology transfer, following a discussion of next steps, including a chair's reflection on areas for further discussion on cross-cutting issues, and a non-paper to facilitate preparations for PrepCom 3. Delegates watched a video message from Academy Award-winning actress Emma Thompson about the need to develop strong international rules to protect the oceans. So, anyway, that's going on right now, even as we speak. Has been since, I guess, late August. August 26th. August 26th was the start date. Well, apparently, okay, I'm wrong. It ended yesterday. So it's not going on as we speak. Just finished. So all of the notes for that will be posted on the IISD.ca website, where there are countless other minute meetings for all of these international meetings that they cover. You can't attend because you may not... Well, I don't even know if you're allowed in. I doubt you are. Even if you could get there, I think you have to either be an NGO or you got to be a stakeholder, listeners, in order to get into these meetings, more than likely. So much for openness, huh? But the point is that you can pull down the minute meetings, the meeting minutes, and see what happened. But few will, unfortunately. And that's the problem. That's the problem. That's been the problem my whole life. How do we get people interested in the plight of our country and the plight of all countries? Because that's really what we're talking about here. All right, moving along here in the interest of time. Press TV went on to interview a Jody Grange from the Green Party from Washington State. Now, this Green Party in Washington State, they aren't happy because, of course, Obama isn't destroying. You know, we were talking earlier about the fact that he agreed, you know, signed on to this Paris Agreement, which he does not have the authority to sign the United States onto. It has to be ratified by the Senate. They want you to forget about that. But he signed us on to it, and now the Green Party's upset because it doesn't destroy the economy quick enough.
The Green Party is disappointed that the efforts are not more robust to lower the emissions from 26 to 28% in 15 years. Does not really reflect the crisis that we are in now. The climate crisis is not just coming, it is here, it is obvious. It is going to require a revolution in the way we do things.
A revolution, ladies and gentlemen. Did you get that? A revolution in the way we do things. And that's exactly what they're looking at. That's exactly what they're going for. This is a revolution. And it is a communist revolution. Only today, it's communitarianism. Blending corporatism with elements of communism and certainly technocratic control every step of the way. Technocratic surveillance every step of the way. All right, moving along here, we have a Zika heads up. Here's a Zika.
My name is Zika. They say I'm mosquito born. I live down south from you. But I'll be in your hood before long. If you hear something late at night, some kind of buzzing, some kind of bite, just don't ask me what it was. Go have sex and donate blood. Who needs a condom? It's Zika love. They say I spread like dengue. The CDC is freaking out. They say I cause Guillain-Barré, which means you won't be walking out. Although you're bit, you shouldn't die. Fever, rash, joint pain, red eyes. Pregnant moms, I must admit, could well be harmed with birth defects. The latest fashion, mosquito nets.
All right, so we know that the hurricane went through the Florida area and has caused a lot of standing water now. And just prior to that happening, they were already building up the possibility, the likelihood, that Zika was going to continue to spread a lot quicker. So what is the solution now? We've talked in the past repeatedly about the fact that there is no scientific connection that microcephaly, birth defects are connected with Zika, but these birth defects are connected with things that they were spraying, ladies and gentlemen. And here we have spraying going on now in Florida. And people are upset about it. The residents, understandably, many of them, are coming out and protesting and fighting this thing. But anyway, we have a report here from a local news outlet.
First at 6, controversial aerial mosquito spraying on Miami Beach delayed for at least one day. It's been a day of protests and debate about the Zika virus. The spraying that was supposed to happen tomorrow morning will now happen on Friday. Still, a lot of people are angry because of the chemicals that will be used. CBS 4's Gary Nelson is live at Miami Beach City Hall with all of today's developments. Gary?
Well, it was a very contentious day here at Miami Beach City Hall, but in the end, concern over the Zika virus and stopping its spread prevailed over those concerned about the aerial spraying that's going to be employed. There was catcalling from the crowd.
Mr. Mayor, you can keep doing that all you want.
Mr. Mayor. And bickering on the dais as Miami Beach commissioners got an earful from a full house most opposed to aerial spraying of the insecticide Naylid to beat back a growing epidemic of the mosquito-borne virus Zika. Naylid spraying is credited with defeating the virus, apparently, in Miami's Wynwood area. But these protesters question the safety of the insecticide.
Something in that chemical is not right, and it's lasting more than an hour. Okay?
This Wynwood woman said her tongue swelled after Naylid was airdropped over her house, but an alphabet soup of federal agencies here declared the pesticide safe for humans. Not enough for one commissioner.
It's a risk-reward that we're just kind of throwing spaghetti at the wall and hoping something sticks.
But Miami-Dade's mayor says there's no choice.
We need to do this to knock down this population of mosquitoes so that we can knock down the occurrence of Zika in Miami Beach and stop this problem here right now.
And for one beach commissioner, with Zika's links to birth defects, it's a no-brainer.
I have an unborn child that I'm taking care of, and I'm worried about Zika.
And Zika already is seeing tourism, Florida's financial engines, start to stall.
Do we do what the health experts are telling us to do? I'm listening to the health experts. That's what they're telling me. That's what I'm listening to.
All right, well, you know what?
In the end, amid all the acrimony and disagreement, the call was made. Aerial spraying of Miami Beach to contain Zika, kill mosquitoes, has to be done.
And it will be done, but not tomorrow morning as scheduled, pushed back a day until Friday morning. Some folks say they would like to have the opportunity to get out of town. The spraying Friday, then again on Sunday, and then two consecutive Sundays after that.
So there you go, ladies and gentlemen, spraying the population with poisons.
What could possibly go wrong?
Unbelievable. We'll be back here in a moment. This is Govern America.
Govern America.
We're just south of the Great Lakes capital city, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, streaming live from FEMA Region 5 in Michigan. Planning Region 2, this is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. Hour number 2, as it continues to be the 10th of September, 2016, getting right back into it here. We just were talking about Zika and some of the things that are happening on a global scale as far as the global meetings are concerned, the implementation of the Paris climate agreement as Obama met with Chinese people over there, Xi Jinping or Hu Flungpu or whatever his name is. Anyway, they're talking about pushing this agreement on the American people. And as I said in the first hour, this is a non-binding agreement, but it will be binding when it's voluntarily adhered to by your local government. And that's the key. I think that that's the way they're going to do it. In the meantime, we see from the Huffington Post, this is an article that was sent to me by a friend of mine, because he was talking about how at one point they're going to ban cigarettes. And he said, look here, here's another example of the argument being made. Will cigarettes be illegal in the future? They say the battle over cigarettes is heating up, and recent news shows the momentum to criminalize tobacco smoking continues to build in the U.S. and around the world. Last week, New York Times reported Himalayan Kingdom Bhutan's war on cigarette smokers. Back in 2005, Bhutan banned the sale of tobacco but made little headway as smugglers brought in cigarettes from India. Now the country is forcing the ban by allowing authorities to break down doors looking for illegal cigarettes. Well, that country is one of many countries, and this is the was my response to him. You got to go back to the World Health Organization and the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. All of this stuff comes from international agreements and UN treaties. On the website for the World Health Organization, they say the Conference of the Parties is the governing body of the World Health Organization Framework Convention on Tobacco Control and is comprised of all parties to the convention. It keeps under regular review the implementation of the convention and takes the decisions necessary to promote its effective implementation and may also adopt protocols, annexes, and amendments to the convention. Observers may also participate in the work of the COP. The work of the COP is governed by its rules of procedure. Starting from COP3, the regular session of COP are held at two-year intervals. Anyway, that's telling a little bit about the convention. They've put out, as I said, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. It is a PDF file. I will put it in the show notes. I found it interesting that this is copyrighted by the World Health Organization. And here's the problem, one of the problems with privatization, too. You have private organizations, ladies and gentlemen. Organizations, not real government bodies, making rules, making regulations for how you're going to live. This is the very definition of governance. It's control. You don't have an actual government, but you have governance, meaning that you have no accountability, no way to see into it. And when their documents are copyrighted, how are you going to be able to distribute them freely? You can't. If you have to pay them for every single copy you get, and you're not able to make it publicly available yourself, now they make these publicly available on their website. But the copyright indicates that if you distribute them, you could end up potentially getting sued. I just thought that was worthy of being pointed out. That's another problem with privatization. Now, this isn't, you know, the World Health Organization isn't a sign of privatization. But private entities can make proprietary works. Private entities can patent their works. And so, as an individual who is trying to rein in out-of-control government, you don't have any ability to get the information. And I come back to the voting systems I was talking about in hour one of the show. Again, that's another example. These electronic voting systems are private. The courts have ruled that they don't have to make their code public. So how are you going to get into it? How are you going to see it? How are you going to find out what it does? Is the point. Now, looking at this framework convention on tobacco control. And am I in favor of tobacco? No. I took one puff of a cigarette. I think I was about 4 years old. And believe me, it cured me for life, for ever wanting to smoke. My Aunt Pat smoked cigarettes, and she was living with us at the time. And I had seen her puff on it before, and I picked it up, thinking, well, you know, it must be good. And I sucked it in, and I coughed and hacked so much, I never, ever wanted to touch another one as long as I lived. And I haven't. But many people, I mean, here's the thing, folks. Tobacco is terrible for your health. But we have no business telling other people what to do. If you want to destroy your health by smoking, that should be your right. Just like if I go out and I want to wear a seatbelt or don't want to wear a seatbelt, that should be my choice. I shouldn't have a law on the books, as we do here in Michigan, that I can be pulled over and issued a citation because I don't wear a seatbelt. We're here to make sure we take care of you. You know, we're the parent here. We at Government House. So we're gonna fine you if you don't do what you're supposed to do. It's not their business. But they've made it their business. Anyway, the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. They have prices and tax measures to reduce the demand for tobacco, non-price measures to reduce the demand, regulation of the contents of products, regulation of tobacco product disclosures, measures relating to the reduction of the supply, tobacco advertising, promotion, and sponsorship. There's a lot to this document. Protection of the environment. protection of the environment and health of persons. Questions related to liability. A scientific and technical cooperation and communication information. Lots to this thing, but it's not really that big of a document. It's only 44 pages. Anybody can read that over probably in a few hours. Anyway, I'll put that in the show notes for those that are interested. Something to be aware of, as they seem to have these more and more of these framework conventions on everything. Everything. Also, I see a press release. This comes from Well, let me just share this with you. The headline is, a European fund firms largely resist tobacco divestment campaign. See, there's too much money in this stuff. There's too much money in addiction to get rid of it. So they're getting backlash. They say 18 months, and this is dated just September 6th, 18 months after the launch of a global campaign to persuade money managers to blacklist tobacco products, just one major European investor has answered the rallying cry. Others are largely sticking with an industry that remains lucrative despite tightening restrictions on smoking and a series of lawsuits in the United States, saying they are only duty-bound. They are duty-bound to seek the best return for their clients. Even a United Nations-backed treaty, which aims to cut the tobacco consumption, and we just shared with you about the treaty, by almost a third within 10 years, is failing to deter many investors in the likes of Philip Morris International, American Tobacco, Japan Tobacco, Imperial Brands. quote, we are firmly of the view that profits, cash, and dividends from tobacco stocks have many years of strong growth ahead, unquote, said Stephen Lamacraft, fund manager at Woodford Investment Management. Still, the Global Task Force for Tobacco Portfolios, backed by the Union for International Cancer Control, has scored one big victory since it began campaigning in March 2015 for financial institutions and pension funds to divest an estimated $60 billion from the industry. In May this year, French insurer and fund manager AXA agreed to ditch its tobacco holdings, becoming the first major European investor to sum up the campaign, although others had already opted out of the tobacco before it was launched. Skipping down here, they say, according to the World Health Organization, tobacco kills around 6 million people each year, including 600,000 non-smokers exposed to secondhand smoke. Many of the passive victims are children. The task force's global project manager, Melbourne-based Bronwyn King, has persuaded more than 30 Australian superannuation funds to ditch tobacco, but the campaign faces a tougher challenge in Europe. Same goes for the United States, where one influential investor, the California Public Employees Retirement System, is reviewing a 16-year investment ban on tobacco after a study estimated the policy had cost it $2 billion to $3 billion in returns. Anyway, it goes on from there, but apparently there's still way too many smokers that they don't want to not, these funds don't want to give up investing in tobacco and cigarettes. And this is a big setback, evidently, for the UN, for the World Health Organization. And again, I'm not for tobacco, listeners. But any setback for the global planners, there's some reason they want this. I think what they want to do, they probably want to create a black market. Because people aren't going to give up their cigarettes. People who are addicts, who are addicted, they're not going to give them up. It's just not that easy. I've seen people over and over again struggle with this. So all it's going to do is create unsafe situations, unsafe conditions for people to buy them. And they could end up having unsafe ingredients. And it can end up causing deaths from things that are in there. I mean, how many times, we've tried prohibition with alcohol. How did that work out? So now we're going to do it with cigarettes, even as, ironically, pot is being legalized by the states. There's a big move to make marijuana legal. So we're going to ban cigarettes. It's just nuts. But that's how these people are. They want to control everything. All right. I'm not going to play the Obama just referred to himself 171 times during a single town hall meeting in Laos. He was over in Laos, and this guy is such a narcissist. Now, I'll put this link in the show notes along with the video. And you can go watch that for yourself if you can stomach it. In the meantime, Hillary Clinton, we see now that the polls, if you want to believe the polls, Trump and Clinton are deadlocked in Florida. The swing states are very important because of the Electoral College situation, regime, or however you want to call it. New Quinnipiac University poll points out, and this was done evidently released on Thursday, shows close races in the four largest, most consequential swing states on the 2016 map. But it also gives Hillary Clinton an edge in two of the four, confirming her Electoral College advantage. Clinton and Donald Trump are running neck and neck in Florida, where the race is deadlocked in Ohio, where Trump leads Clinton by a single percentage point. But Clinton has a four-point lead in North Carolina. A poll there shows and a five-point edge in Pennsylvania. I really shudder to see where we're going to be in 4 years. I feel like we've been on borrowed time for so long. And we have a lot of Americans waking up. But is it too little, too late? I don't believe so. I wouldn't be sitting on behind this microphone if I thought it was over, folks. As the words of my good friend Roger Mundy, back when he was alive, he used to always say, it's not over until it's overcome. Got to stay in the fight. Keep your chin up, ladies and gentlemen. In the meantime, Hillary Clinton is, let's talk about her FBI interview and the fact that, she had Cheryl Mills there. Apparently it's been revealed now. National Review says that David and Rich have already noted FBI's 302-page report, or FBI 302 report, of the interview of Hillary Clinton, along with the other notes of investigation that were released September 2nd, make for mind-boggling reading. Most bracing is the fact that Mrs. Clinton had her server wiped clean sometime between March 25th and 31st, 2015, only 3 weeks after the New York Times on March 3rd broke the story of the server system's existence. David notes that at the time, the Democrats, Janus-faced presidential nominee, was outwardly taking the position that she wanted the public to see my email, and that's a quote. She was having her minions frantically purge her emails behind the scenes. Unbelievable. And what I want to know is, why isn't this woman being prosecuted by the FBI for destruction of evidence? Well, that's a rhetorical question. We know the answer, don't we? Anyway, Lawrence O'Donnell is a political analyst. He was on The Morning Joe. He's discussing the role that Cheryl Mills plays and the fact that she was at the FBI interview with Hillary Clinton, serving as her legal advisor, even as she, Cheryl Mills herself, was a suspect. Now, what's wrong with this picture, ladies and gentlemen? Now, first you'll hear Joel Scarborough, the host of the show.
So, Lawrence, several months ago, probably 4 or 5 months ago, I said, okay, we're not going to talk about the emails anymore, because if she's indicted, then it's a big deal.
Right.
And if she's not indicted, it's not going to be a big deal. I advanced that to right now, and I mean politically.
Okay, first of all, let me jump in here. That just shows you the bias of the establishment media. Oh, we're not going to talk about it unless she's indicted. Well, excuse me, it's a big deal either way. What we're talking about here is national security, Joe. What we're talking about here, you know, and Hillary Clinton gets up and very disingenuously says, oh, classified information has a header on it. So if it doesn't have a header, that means it's not classified. No, you can send, and bear in mind, I have to point out here too, I don't agree with the level of classification that's going on. I mean, everything's a secret anymore. Nothing is revealed anymore. It's all classified, all secret, all sensitive. Anything that's embarrassing is secret or sensitive. But the notion that just because it's not stamped classified, you can't reveal state secrets is hogwash. It's absurd. But that's the case Hillary Clinton now is trying to make. Oh, it's got a header on it if it's classified, so my emails couldn't be classified. Anyway, they continue.
So when I talk about the FBI notes that came out on the Friday before Labor Day, right, about the interview of Hillary Clinton that came out on the Saturday of 4th of July weekend, this is actually not about Hillary Clinton or even Cheryl Mills, who's just, my God, I cannot believe Cheryl Mills gets away with what she gets away with year in and year out. But this is about the FBI's integrity. When you saw the notes, when you read all the articles, when you saw the timing of it drop, institutionally, did your opinion of the FBI increase or decrease? And do you think it puts a blot on Jim Comey's otherwise stellar reputation.
Well, it's hard to change my view of the
Jim Comey has a stellar reputation. What, prosecuting Martha Stewart?
Yeah, because I've never seen one of these files before. You know, they've never shown, they've never turned in their homework before.
Well, exactly, so which is another part of the story.
Yeah, but I mean, there's one really striking thing in it, just procedurally, which is Cheryl Mills being in the interview with Hillary Clinton. Cheryl Mills is one of the principals. Investigators would call her a suspect at that point. What is she doing in the interview with Hillary Clinton? And the claim is she's in here as Hillary Clinton's lawyer, one of many in the room with Hillary Clinton. That was really peculiar, really strange. But then again, this is not the prosecutorial stage. This is the FBI stage. And truly, we have never seen how this procedure works.
Incredible. And I think the FBI is completely compromised. We've talked about this before. But it's obvious the FBI is playing for Hillary. Now, Andrew Napolitano was on with Megyn Kelly talking about this, and they were discussing the possibility that the White House may have stood the FBI down. Now, I don't know if they would have to. I mean, James Comey has done other investigations in the past, which apparently have worked out in favor of the Clintons as well. But we know that the Department of Justice had a meeting with Bill Clinton. Or Bill Clinton had a meeting with Loretta Lynch, let me be more specific here, aboard an airplane just prior to the FBI's announcement that they would not recommend any prosecution against Hillary Clinton. And then you had on the heels of the FBI scathing, I want to say the word indictment, but it wasn't an indictment. It was a scathing criticism. But it stopped short of recommending prosecutions. They said she was extraordinarily reckless and blah, blah, blah. And then we had Loretta Lynch come out on after that and say, oh, well, see there, you know, the FBI is saying we shouldn't prosecute, so we're not going to prosecute. And the fix was in the whole time. And then if Hillary gets elected, more than likely she's going to keep Loretta Lynch. They've already made, I think, a deal was made, honestly. I think that's fairly obvious. A deal was made. So we have this conversation between Megyn Kelly and Andrew Napolitano.
Joining me now, Fox News senior judicial analyst, Judge Andrew Napolitano, who reviewed these FBI documents. And he joins us now with what he found, dumped right before Labor Day, as she's done this four times now. She's actually, you know, she or her team.
Right.
They somehow always find a way before Memorial Day, before July 4th, before Labor Day. And then the other one was New Year's Eve, right?
Right.
Those are the four. Look, there it is. Purely coincidental. What may have happened here is important. You don't get a subpoena and then start destroying documents.
Well,
that's not okay.
Okay, so that is what happened here. Congressman Chaffetz is correct in his timeline. The subpoena was issued and then the documents were destroyed. Congressman Gowdy is correct. We're talking about two different committees. Congressman Chaffetz runs the House Oversight Committee. Congressman Gowdy, the House Benghazi Committee. Both put on notice Secretary Clinton. In fact, Congressman Gowdy's committee put Secretary Clinton on notice while she was still Secretary of State.
Because they were like, wait a minute,
you have your
own private server? And you didn't give us any of the documents from it in response to our earlier subpoenas? Well, we want that.
And
you better not destroy anything now and the time we get it. And she did.
Correct. Now we found out that it was destroyed. Now here's the very, very troubling news. We learned this on Friday. We learned this from the FBI. Mm-hmm. The FBI knew that servers were wiped clean, that BlackBerries were smashed and destroyed, and that a laptop was lost in the U.S. mail. The FBI ought to have pursued Mrs. Clinton and the people around her for obstruction of justice, and it did not do so. That is exceptionally distressing. The case against her for failure to secure state secrets is overwhelming. Now the case against somebody, we don't know who, for obstruction of justice is overwhelming, and Megan, the FBI has done nothing. Someone, somewhere, it must be the White House, has restrained the FBI from doing its job.
You look at the evidence right before this Platte River Networks. They were the ones who deleted her email archives pursuant to her order is how it looks. This is the guy who had the oh blank moment.
Right.
He had been told to do it before.
Right.
He claims, oh, I forgot, and then I saw the subpoena, and suddenly I remembered. I was supposed to delete everything, everything of interest.
They're going to blame me. I better take a sledgehammer to a couple of blackberries.
Right, so, but here's what happened before he did the deleting after the subpoena. He had a conference call with Secretary Clinton's attorneys just days before the deletions, created a work ticket on or about the day of the deletion, used BleachBit, a software program designed to prevent recovery of evidence, manual deletion of backups, and on it goes. And the question is, was this intentional, and what were they hiding, if anything?
How could it not have been intentional?
Okay, we're going to continue this on the other side of the break. Stay with us, folks. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. We'll be back in a moment. All right, we're back. This is Govern America. Our website is governamerica.com. That's governamerica.com. Talking about the corruption with the Hillary mess, which never ceases to end. And Judge Andrew Napolitano was on with Fox News' Megyn Kelly talking about how whether or not the FBI was stood down. We started this before the break. And continue on here.
Used BleachBit, a software program designed to prevent recovery of evidence, manual deletion of backups, and on it goes. And the question is, was this intentional, and what were they hiding, if anything?
How could it not have been intentional with the regular, consistent, systematic destruction of evidence? And I'm sorry to tell you, her lawyers may have been involved in this, which adds another entirely different level of culpability.
What if they say none of this stuff was responsive, and therefore we didn't need to keep it? It was all yoga, blah, blah, blah. You know, like that was, who cares? We could delete that stuff.
She swore under oath to a federal judge, and she swore under oath to two congressional committees. She returned all of her work-related emails. The FBI found 17,800 work-related emails that she failed to return. Not all of them were readable because some of them had been destroyed. You tell me that's not a prima facie case of obstruction of justice, and the FBI has done nothing about it. And I don't know how far Congressman Chaffetz is going to go. Election Day is 63 days from now. I don't even know that he could get to first base between now and Election Day.
You say the DOJ actually, I mean the FBI actually violated policy in that interview. You believe they violated their own policy.
Yes.
How?
Her lawyers told the DOJ she will not show up for an interview if you record it. It is policy of the DOJ to record every interview. There is no record of what she said other than the summaries written by the FBI agents who were in the room and who listened to her. In this digital age, there is no recording. There's a verbatim recording of every single other one of the witnesses interrogated in this case, except for Mrs. Clinton.
Wow. I'm sure.
How far can this go?
I'm sure the average Joe watching at home right now could get such an exception as well. I'm sure.
Right.
If they got in trouble, there'd be no problem with all the stories that she has told that have turned out just not to add up. And then this. Listen, maybe there'll be an explanation other than the FBI has cleared me and you're all a bunch of idiots.
And that is exactly what she's saying. She's not saying it in those words, but she is saying that the FBI cleared me. This has been dealt with. We've got that clip, too. Anyway, Hillary held a rally in Ohio 5 days ago. And of course, the most pressing issue, ladies and gentlemen, and this is why you don't want her under any circumstance as president, because everything she does is going to be geared toward this.
One threat here right at home, the epidemic of gun violence. And we have got to have comprehensive background checks, close the gun show loophole, close the online loophole, and the ability of people on the terrorist watch list buying a gun in America. This agenda I've just briefly outlined is supported by a vast majority of Americans and a vast majority of American gun owners.
Okay, that is absolutely not true. The vast majority of American gun owners don't want any more restrictions, any restrictions on their firearms rights.
And it's time we all said in one voice, hey, we can respect the Second Amendment, we can respect the right to own arms, but we don't want people who shouldn't have guns in the first place killing anybody else ever again.
Okay, first of all, to respect the Second Amendment means shall not be infringed. What part of shall not be infringed do you not understand, you... I'm going to try to be nice. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, we're in for a ride. I tell you what, I won't lack for show material, but man, would I love to lack for show material. Wow. Anyway, LA Times, no, Washington Post put out a article. Can we just stop talking about Hillary Clinton's health now? where they have multiple pictures, you know, a montage of her coughing photos from different venues, which evidently was put up on the Drudge Report, with the headlines, 10 doctors question Hillary's health, MSNBC cuts live feed as she sputters for air, fit lasted for over 4 minutes, she slams conspiracy theories, media blames pollen, complete timeline of 2016 coughing fits, Pruden, voters have right to ask, thyroid problems linked to sudden cardiac death. I don't know if they're saying she has a thyroid issue. I guess, you know, that was probably, I'm trying to remember if that was one of the things that was mentioned in her, in that health report that was leaked, which Dr. Drew got fired talking about. But, this is this Ohio rally. She started talking, you know, she got up there and started talking, and she ended up barely able. She was barely able to get it out. She was barely able to continue talking. And I, you know, here, okay, listen to this.
Happy, happy Labor Day. When we were trying to figure out where we could be, we all said, let's go to Cleveland. And I want to thank Congresswoman Marsha Fudge for hosting us. I've been talking so... Every time I think about Trump, I get allergic. Boy, we have 63 days to go.
and folks, I cut it off there because it's you know, not good radio to go on and on and on with somebody just coughing on the air. But this went on for several minutes. I mean, I think it was over 4 minutes, maybe 5 minutes, solid. That's all she did was try to talk, use that old voice that she just used, and hack and cough her brains out. And something is really wrong with this woman. The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons is a nonprofit professional association of physicians in all types of practices and specialties across the country. Their website says they're dedicated to the highest ethical standard of the oath of the Hippocratic Oath, in other words, and to preserving the sanctity of the patient-physician relationship in the practice of medicine. They came out with a statement. And they say Hillary's health concerns are serious, say most doctors polled by the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. Concerns about, and this was just 2 days ago they put this out, concerns about Hillary Clinton's health are serious, could be disqualifying for the position of President of the United States, say nearly 71% listeners, of 250 physicians responding to an informal internet survey by the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. About 20% said concerns are likely overblown. Only 20% said that, but should be addressed by a full release of medical records. Only 2.7% responded that they were just a political attack. I have confidence in the letter from her physician and see no cause for concern. Only 2.7%. So an overwhelming majority of doctors that have been polled said, no, this is serious. This is a real concern. More than 81% were aware of her history of a concussion. Only 59% were aware of the cerebral sinus thrombosis, and 52% of the history of deep venous thrombosis. More than 78% said the health concerns had received not enough emphasis in the media. 78% said that. Not enough emphasis in the media. And only 2.7% that there had been too much emphasis. So many doctors are evidently very concerned about what's going on with Hillary's health. And, you know, I've got some theories about this. I don't know the reason for the coughing, but I was watching the event they had the other day where NBC, MSNBC, and NBC held an event with Matt Lauer moderating, and the event was called the Commander-in-Chief Forum. And this was not a debate. Some people have called it a debate. They were not even on the platform at the same time, so there's no debate. What it was is they called it a forum. I think that's a good word. But Matt Lauer basically drilling both candidates and audience members doing the same. But I noticed during this event that her head was bopping. She was bobbing like a bop, you know, like one of those bobblehead dolls. Just very much not as bad as the attack that happened when the reporters had surrounded her with tape recorders and microphones. It wasn't quite that bad, but it was still very noticeable. And it reminded me of Janet Reno. You remember Janet Reno would get on TV and she'd be quaking like an earthquake. I'm thinking this woman's got the beginning stages of Parkinson's disease, ladies and gentlemen. This looked a lot to me. I mean, she doesn't have control of her head. Her head is moving and bopping up and down. It looked like she could have had headphones on listening to some song, bopping her head back and forth. Now, nobody, to my knowledge, has ever brought this up about her in that event. But you could clearly see her bopping her head back and forth. And I think back to the Clinton years when they were in office and the rumors that were floating around about how the whole thing being the White House was just flooded with cocaine. Cocaine everywhere. And here we see from the New York Post, more recently, June of this year, Clinton White House was a den of coke mistresses, ex-Secret Service officer says. And they talk about this Gary Byrne, who's got a book out. And he was evidently a guard outside the Oval Office. He talks, I've seen him in other venues, other places, talking about, you know, the whole Monica Lewinsky debacle. But trying to find the place in this article where it talks about the cocaine. Okay. For one, he thinks Clinton... Okay. Byrne says he wants Americans to vote their conscience, but pledges to make sure that they have all the information that they need. For one, he thinks the Clintons' own behavior bred an immoral White House culture. Byrne reveals to the Post during the interview that Clinton staffers used cocaine on the job. There were some drug issues, he said. Some people would come into work in the morning and they were barely walking. And they would drop stuff off at the office and go to the restroom, where they would come out minutes later happy as a clown. He also exposes the jogging list for some time. In the beginning of the first administration, when Clinton was jogging outside, women were dressed as if they were going clubbing or working out. They started showing up at the southeast gate. The agents would get women's names and run them to see who they were. If the women wouldn't cooperate, they would be ushered out of the jogging group. Agents insinuated that this list was used by President Clinton to try to meet these women. The book details how the president had as many as three mistresses during the same time period, including former Vice President Walter Mondale's daughter, Eleanor, whom Byrne once discovered making out on the map room table with Bill Clinton. Unbelievable. What bothered Byrne more than the infidelity was the way Bill Clinton programmed the entire White House to accommodate his cheating ways. Anyway, it goes on from there. But the thing I was interested at this point was the drug issues. Because I remember them talking about how Bill Clinton had half a Columbia up his nose. And this has been many of the people, the insiders there. Well, more than one, let's put it that way. I shouldn't say many. I don't know how many. But there have been a lot of smoke to this, in other words. And is it all just rumor, ladies and gentlemen? I don't think so. I think Jennifer Flowers was one that said Bill Clinton used to talk to her about getting messed up. Effed up is what he said. On coke at parties and what have you. The reason why I'm bringing this up is because if Bill Clinton was involved in snorting a lot of cocaine, are we to believe that Hillary Clinton sat idly by and didn't take part? I think it's very likely she was right there with him doing it too. I think it would be almost silly to suggest that she didn't. Unrealistic is the word. And here we see from Science Daily. My hunch last night, or the other night, a couple of nights ago, as I began to look at this like a possible case of Parkinson's disease, with the head bopping. Now, I don't know what the coughing is, but there is a link between cocaine abuse and Parkinson's disease. Science Daily says adults who abuse cocaine might increase their risk of developing Parkinson's disease, and pregnant women who abuse cocaine could increase the risk of their children developing Parkinson's disease later in life, according to results in laboratory studies performed by investigators of St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. Adults who abuse cocaine might... They're just restating it. The study's findings are important because there are currently more than 2 million cocaine abusers in the U.S. today. Many individuals who abused the drug during the height of the cocaine abuse epidemic of the 1970s and 80s. How about the 1960s, listeners? But they say many of the individuals who abused the drugs during the height of the cocaine abuse epidemic of the 1970s and 80s are now entering their older years when symptoms of Parkinson's disease are likely to emerge. So where does that put Bill and Hillary Clinton? Could their symptoms now are they starting to emerge? A report on this work appears in the online pre-publication edition of Neuroscience. The St. Jude team showed in laboratory models of both the adult and fetal brains that exposure to cocaine alters the nerve bodies in the region of the brain called the substantia nigra. This damage made the neurons more susceptible to MPTP, a toxin known to cause symptoms of Parkinson's disease. Now, part of this ailment, this Parkinson's disease, is the loss of muscular control. You know, it's a neurological thing. And I'm wondering, too, if this isn't the reason why she's having difficulty walking upstairs and standing up for extended periods of time. And I don't know, it could even have something to do with the coughing. Because, you know, muscles in the throat, maybe saliva control is a problem. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I'm not trying to pretend to be a doctor. But I think this is very plausible that she might have the beginning stages of Parkinson's disease, and they just don't want anybody to know it. All right, moving along here. Let me find out where I'm at here. All right, following the Ohio rally, which we shared some with you earlier, Hillary Clinton had a press gaggle. Now, keep in mind, it's been a long time. Long time. She had a press gaggle with reporters on her new plane. She had to start talking to the press. Press, as I said, her poll numbers were falling. Trump is gaining on her. And there was growing criticism that she had been hiding to avoid the tough questions, including questions about her health, which we were just sharing. She hadn't held a press conference, anything resembling a press conference, for 275 days now, ladies and gentlemen. And for a presidential candidate, it's about unheard of, I think. It's important to note the difference between a press gaggle and a press conference, by the way. She held at least two gaggles on her plane. There was maybe even more. Those are not press conferences. She did do a real press conference on later on the ground, but the plane events, the folks, these are hand-picked reporters in an informal setting, traveling with Hillary at her pleasure. Just remember, gaggle is informal. Press conference is formal. If any of the reporters ask too many real hardline questions, she has the power to ban them from further travel with her. Do you think that they're going to make any waves with her? As a matter of fact, one of the reporters that was accompanying her was Andrea Mitchell, you know, the former wife of Alan Greenspan. And at a press conference on the ground, this is what Hillary said to Andrea.
I love you, Andrea. You are indefatigable. You're my kind of a woman. I'll tell you what. Look at this. Okay. I know. Go ahead.
See, this is the kind of relationship she has with these people, these hand-picked reporters. I wonder if RT was allowed on the plane. I highly doubt it. But anyway, so even the number of people they picked, you know, she can pick more friendly people, people who are more in line, less likely to press her too hard on certain issues, you know, her apologists. So that was, as I said, that was from a press conference on the ground. But she's having a love fest with these people. And now back to one of the gaggles on the plane. She was answering a question from a reporter about whether the Russians were trying to help Trump by hacking the DNC. This has been an ongoing issue, you know, an ongoing meme, I should say. They're really trying to chalk up the Russians as being a threat. They're going to hack the elections, hacking the DNC, blah, blah, blah. So, of course, this is, and by the way, where are they headed with this? The Russians are hacking the elections. We know that Soros, we now know that Soros is attempting to push for internet voting. So look for internet voting to be the solution, which would do nothing to create security. In fact, it would be just the opposite. It would make elections that much more hackable. The internet should not be something. Internet security is extremely hard. Internet security is ridiculously hard. So anyway, they're pushing this meme, though, that the Russians are going to hack the election. The Russians are helping Trump by hacking the DNC. And of course, this is one of those softball questions I was talking about. First of all, it's not a proven fact, by the way, that the Russian government was even behind the hack of the DNC. But, you know, hey, as they used to joke in the newsroom back when I worked at the CBS and NBC affiliates, you know, never let the facts get in the way of a good story, huh? Anyway, Hillary's answering this question, and she again erupts into a coughing fit.
I think it's quite intriguing that this activity has happened around the time Trump became the nominee. And look, he very early on allied himself with Putin's policies. I mean, to pull out of NATO, for goodness sakes, right? And he furthermore has praised Putin. He seems to have this, you know, bizarre attraction to dictators, including Putin. He won't tell us where he owes $650 million. There's a lot of rumors about that. And he has, you know, made it clear that he doesn't particularly care whether Putin and the intelligence services attack American institutions. So, get some water.
Yep.
Thank you. Thanks. Excuse me. I'll be right back.
So that's it. She wandered off and ended up having to discontinue the press conference because she couldn't continue. But Hillary Clinton talking about Donald Trump's integrity, wow, that's rich, folks. That's really rich. Anyway, we'll continue in hour number 3 already. Unbelievable how fast the time's going. Stay with us. This is Govern America. I'm Darren Weeks. Please don't go away.
Govern America.
Capital City, covering all of North America via satellite, micro FM stations all across the country, streaming live from FEMA Region 5 and Michigan Planning Region 2. This is Govern America, hour number 3. As we continue on here, I was out of the room, and the break went by a little quicker than I thought. So I got back here just in the nick of time. Anyway, moving along here, you're welcome to call in, by the way, if you want. 1-844-646-8376. That's 1-844-646-8376. Or 1-844-6-GOVERN. Also want to get into this situation with Donald Trump and the Trump University thing, because this is something that I think has the potential to significantly hurt him. But before the break, we were playing audio from Hillary Clinton at a press gaggle on a plane. She went back. She went into one of her coughing fits, had to go away and suspend the conference or the gaggle. And she came back then afterwards and continued and actually had the audacity to say this.
Finally, I heard, now that we've got this great plane, that Donald Trump actually invited his press onto his plane, where I'm told he even answered a few questions. So following my lead, as he just did, I would hope he continues and releases his tax returns.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. After 275 days of not talking to the media at all, she says, oh, yeah, he's following my lead, inviting the press. He's been holding press conferences all along. And she's the one that's been hiding from the media. Unbelievable hypocrisy. But anyway, she was asked about the Trump Foundation, and she made a comment about how taken aback she was by the corruption.
Your second question was about the Trump Foundation, right? And I am quite taken aback by the foundation making a political contribution to the Florida Attorney General, who was just about to investigate Trump University, and then ending the investigation. I mean, there's so many things that are questionable about that, and the IRS certainly thought so and said it was illegal and fined Trump for that set of facts.
Okay, I want to get into this a little bit here because I've discovered some interesting stuff about this. First of all, in my research, I discovered the Washington Post had an article, How Donald Trump Made It Look Like He Was Bribing the Attorney General of Florida. In this article, they publish a timeline. And the timeline, they cite this watchdog group called Crew. They say, let me back up here. Well, they start off talking about how, you know, Trump kind of brags, and he has bragged, and it is true that he's, like in one of the debates for the primaries, he got up there and was talking about, you know, how part of the problem, we got a broken system in America, he says, because I pay both candidates, I donate to both candidates, and so that whoever gets in office can do whatever they want. Whatever I want. You know, basically, he admitted he's buying their influence. He's paying them money to get them to do what he wants them to do. Now, we could talk about how the problem here, there's the problem with that is, of course, obvious. Because those of us who don't have a lot of money, we can't buy the government we want. We can't pay, and that's what's so horrendous about the thought that Hillary Clinton, when she's at the State Department, is taking bribes from foreign powers, from foreign governments, and from corporations. Now, is this a requirement for big business to operate anymore? Is it just expected that they're going to donate to presidential campaigns or something, because otherwise they may have unfavorable business regulations? If it is, then we're in big, big trouble. And I have a feeling this is kind of where we've arrived at. I know, and this is not just a federal problem, ladies and gentlemen. I know this problem goes on state and local levels as well. Seems like the bigger the town, the worse it is. But even small towns have corruption. But I know for a fact, you know, back when we were doing the Hammerstrom expose, and I worked to get the media, our local media, involved, I went to, when I worked at Channel 6, I went to my news director, the guy that headed the whole news department. His name was Phil Hendricks. He was a very nice guy. And I presented to him documentation proving that we had a state legislator here in Michigan that was involved with a Washington, D.C.-based group called Women in Government, which was receiving money from pharmaceutical companies, one of which was Merck, I believe, if I recall correctly, which was the maker of this, what's the name of it? It was Merck. It might have been GlaxoSmithKline. I'm blanking now on the details. It's been so many years ago. But anyway, the pharmaceutical company that was making these shots for young girls to fight the human papillomavirus, HPV, as they call it. And there are three shots these girls are supposed to get. Anyway, the drug manufacturer for that, and it seems like it was GlaxoSmithKline, but I can't remember now for sure. But this group, Women in Government, was receiving money from the pharmaceutical companies, one of which was pushing this legislation to be passed in all states. And Hammerstrom's tied up in that with the group. In fact, you could see on the group's website, she was the immediate past chair of the group. And I found this out, that she was involved with that, from talking to one of her staffers on the phone. We had a conversation. That was nice. You know, this is why you don't be rude to these people when you call, because if you get them talking, get them chatty, sometimes they reveal things to you. And I was just expressing my concern about the bill that Hammerstrom was introducing and pushing in the legislature, making it compulsory for sixth grade girls to be vaccinated with this concoction. And having daughters of my own, I had a real stake in this whole thing. But I would have been livid anyway. The point is that I was expressing my concern, and she says, "Well, you know, I can assure you that it's safe, you know, and you know, Beverly Hammerstrom has done her homework on this, and matter of fact, she's, you know, there's a lot of people involved in this." And I'm like, "Oh," then my antennas go up when she said, "There's a lot of people involved in this issue." I said, "Oh, really? Well, who would they be? Who are all the people involved?" And so she told me about the Women in Government group. So after I got off the phone with her, I went to their website. Sure enough, pharmaceutical companies just funding this group left and right. And there were other companies as well. And no telling what other kind of legislation it's pushed to serve their sponsors, their underwriters. So I got all these things together and took them into Phil Hendricks. And I said, "Hey, I got a story for you." And at the time, he was with an intern. He says, "Can you print it all out?" I says, "I sure can." So I went back and to the other room and printed it out, came back, laid it all out for him. The following day, 5 o'clock, they did a story on Beverly Hammerstrom and her conflicts of interest. And that woman was hiding behind her desk. She was trying to sink down behind her desk. She had been caught. But Phil told me after that whole thing was over, he said, "You know, they said to our news guys when we were there, we don't understand what the problem is. This is something that happens all the time. Why are you making a big deal out of this?" And this is the problem with the media. And I didn't tell him that because I was grateful that they actually did the story. But why isn't the media investigating this? And you can say, "Well, the media is complicit." Well, they're only complicit because they're silent and they're not really doing any investigative reporting. The problem with a lot of the media, and I'm going to tell you this right now, as somebody who's been involved with media, local media at least. I can't speak for the nationals. I think the nationals are more tightly controlled and infiltrated by intelligence agencies and shills for the New World Order. But I can tell you from local media, at least medium-sized markets, maybe the larger markets are more network-like, but medium-sized markets, your average market size, many of these people are fresh out of college. Many of these people, the reporters, even anchors, some of these people start at these TV stations and they're interns when they start. They make their debut on television sometimes as interns. We had one when I worked at an NBC affiliate. And I know I'm getting off track here, and we'll get back to the subject at hand in a moment. But I can tell you that we had one girl who started as a college intern. And in just a few years, made her way up from college intern to producer. And just in a few years, ended up as news director over the whole department. Now, she was a very kind of aggressive type of personality. I mean, I don't mean she was mean. I always got along with her well. But she was very focused. But in a very short period of time, she went from an intern to the manager of the whole place. And it's not uncommon for inexperienced people, is what I'm trying to say, to decide what stories you're going to see on TV and TV news. And I can only speak for TV news because that's where I've operated at in much of my career. Many of these people have no life experience, no real experience. All they know is what they're being taught at these indoctrination universities and colleges. And so they get there and they're going to tell you what's going on. Where's the investigative journalism? Why aren't they at the Capitol? Why aren't they pounding the pavement? Why don't they reveal these conflicts of interest that are going on a regular basis that is literally killing our country, killing our states? The corruption has been allowed to fester to the point where, how do you root it out? How do you root it out when it's just accepted as legitimate? Anyway, the Washington Post published this timeline, as I was saying, about the Trump fiasco. The timeline came from an organization called Crew. And, you know, I got to wondering because they say on this Washington Post piece, talking about how he was bragging about, you know, paying politicians to do, you know, basically donating to their campaign. Then if he needs to call upon them for a favor or something a few years later, he's able to do that. Now, we can trash him for that. But unfortunately, I think most big businesses do that anymore. And I'm not saying it's right, but do they just consider it a cost of doing business? And that's the problem. The quote is, as a businessman, and this is Trump talking, I think, as a business and a very substantial donor to very important people, when you give, they do whatever the hell you want them to do. As a businessman, I need that. That's what Donald Trump said to the Wall Street Journal. And as you recall, the first debate of the Republican primaries, Fox News' Brett Baier, questioned Trump about this point. He said you recently, and he recited the quote, and Trump confirmed. He said, you better believe it. He says, I will tell you that our system is broken. I gave to many people before this. Before 2 months ago, I was a businessman. I give to everybody. When they call, I give. And you know what? When I need something from them 2 years later, 3 years later, I call them and they are there for me. Okay, now they say that's pay for play for Trump has talked about so much recently in another context. He paid, they played. With his characteristic bravado, Trump bragged about being a participant in the corruption that he was setting out to fix. As far as rhetoric goes, it's a tricky line to walk. But when questions arose about Trump actually giving money to get a benefit from politicians, those comments came back to haunt him. Now, my question is, was this a case where he's paying to get benefits, or was it a case where he was being extorted? Because this, and what we're talking about here is $25,000 that his foundation gave to an organization that was funding Pam Bondi, the Attorney General of Florida's campaign. She solicited the contribution, apparently. And apparently, okay, the group called Crew put out this. Now, I'm going to do a more of a deep dive on Crew in just a moment. But they say Crew, this, which is Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, they say Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi will speak at the Republican National Convention on behalf of Donald Trump. And apparently that happened. Like many speakers, she has a personal history with Trump, but it's unlikely that any other speaker's relationship with Trump has led to so many legal complaints or so many unanswered questions. Trump and Bondi are entangled in a major political scandal involving $25,000 illegal contribution made by the Trump Foundation, a nonprofit charitable foundation to a political group supporting Bondi's election. Bondi personally solicited the contribution from Trump himself and received it around the time it was reported that her office was investigating Trump University. Now, I don't know what happened with Trump University. There's a lot of debate or talk about that. You know, the allegations are that they were ripping off people, that they were using boiler room tactics to, you know, sell courses or something. And I don't know who these people are that complained. And that's something that would be interesting to find out, how much substance there is as far as that is concerned. Because unfortunately, you're not going to get those kind of investigations from the establishment media. At least I haven't seen any so far. And the establishment media tends to favor Hillary anyway. So they say after the contribution, Bonnie's office told reporters there was no investigation into Trump. The Trump Foundation told the IRS it made no political contributions, and instead of listing the Bondi Group, listed a Kansas organization with a similar name to which they could legally donate. Crew's investigation has led to a complaint with the IRS against the Trump Foundation. Now, this is the complaint that they filed. They filed a complaint. And apparently now he has been fined by the IRS. And I'm wondering now if this isn't the reason why he's being audited by the IRS. Could it all stem from this group called Crew? And that's against the Trump Foundation. I guess it's personal. Anyway, it led to complaints against Bondi also and with the Inspector General of Florida's office of the Attorney General and the State Commission on Ethics. Okay, now, they published this timeline. They published a list of questions they think Trump should answer, blah, blah, blah. Going down to this list of timeline, a timeline of events. May 2011, Florida Attorney's Office, General's Office, receives at least 22 complaints regarding Trump University, the Trump Institute, and related entities. Now, there's some speculation that these 22 complaints aren't really 22 complaints at all. But, okay, we'll just say it's 22 for lack of a better number at this point. August 2013, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman files lawsuit against Donald Trump, the Trump Entrepreneur Institute, a.k.a. Trump University, and the former president of Trump University for engaging in persistent, fraudulent, illegal, and deceptive conduct. Now, let me just say one thing here as a side note. If it's a university, more than likely, it's fraudulent, okay? Because I can tell you, folks, every university is a fraud. Every university, the whole thing is a scam. They're there to take your money. Okay? So let's just get that settled right now. Every university, they rape their students. They make their money. They're there to take your money. And if you get an education, you get a degree, it's a side effect of them just, okay. I made my point. September 13, 2013, the Orlando Sentinel reports that OAG told them, "We are currently reviewing the allegations in the New York lawsuit." A few days later, OAG tells the Palm Beach Post the same thing. September 17, 2013, the Donald J. Trump Foundation makes a $25,000 contribution to And Justice for All, a political group backing Bondi. The donation, which is illegal for a 501c3 private foundation to give, was personally solicited by Bondi from Trump. So, I think it's interesting. She solicited money. He's in trouble, facing the possibility of being investigated by this Bondi, Pam Bondi, Attorney General, And she solicits a $25,000 contribution. This smells to me a little bit like extortion. I'm wondering if he's not being wasn't being extorted. October 15, 2013, according to documents turned over in response to a crew public records request, OAG told reporters that there was no consideration of whether to join the New York lawsuit in light of the fact that the Attorney General's office received only one consumer complaint 2.5 years ago. There is no investigation at this time. Now, wait a minute. This is what I was telling you before. This is 2 years after the fact. Let me share this again. According to documents turned over in response to a crew public records request, OAG, the office, what was the OAG? Florida Office of the Attorney General. They told reporters that there was no consideration of whether to join the New York lawsuit in light of the fact that the Attorney General's office received only one consumer complaint 2.5 years ago. There's no investigation at this time. So how do we know if they said they only received one complaint that they received 22 complaints? Do you see what I'm saying? Earlier they said that the Florida Office of Attorney General had received 22 complaints regarding the university. So which is it? The Tampa Bay Times on October 17, 2013 reports that And Justice for All, the group, Bonnie's group, acknowledged receiving the contribution from the Trump Foundation. October 17 to 18, 2013, despite previously acknowledging the 22 complaints, they say, and bear in mind, this is the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Government saying this, and there are some reason to doubt what they say, and I'll get to that in a moment. Despite previously acknowledging the 22 complaints, they say, sometimes 23 due to a duplicate record, to reporters, internal emails show OAG employees weeded out any complaint about Trump Institute and related entities to claim there was only one complaint against Trump Institute. In 2014, they say that the Trump Foundation claimed in its 2013 taxes that it made no donations to political entities and replaces And Justice for All with a different, similar named group in Kansas to which they would legally be allowed to donate. And then on March 21st of this year, they say Crew files an IRS complaint against the Trump Foundation for making the illegal political donation. Now, I wanted to find out more about this organization. And in the course of my research, I discovered a website called Crew Exposed. And they say Citizens for Responsible and Ethics in Washington is not what it seems. And it seems to confirm exactly what I had suspected. And I'll tell you what that is on the other side of the break. How's that for a cliffhanger? Stay with us, folks. We'll be back. This is Govern America. Don't go away. All right, we're back. This is Govern America. The website is governamerica.com. That's governamerica.com. As we continue here, talking about the Trump University allegations and who's behind this whole push to bring this out into the forefront. I don't know what's going on with this entirely, but given Hillary Clinton's massive amount of corruption, this is going to give the media something to distract from that and focus on Trump. Who's behind it? Well, we were talking before the break about this group called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. And as I said before the break, I discovered in my research this website called CrewExposed.com. CrewDoc.com, where they talk about who's who at Crew. Because the reason why I started digging into them is because I went to their website and I started noticing that most of the people that they were investigating or exposing or, you know, they were all Republican or conservative candidates for the most part. And so I did a little digging about to find out a little bit more information about them. And that's what led me to this CrewExposed.com, where they say the idea for Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington was conceived by Norman Eisen and Louis Mayberg, two lawyers who often donated to Democratic causes. The two decided that they needed a government watchdog to mirror the conservative ethics groups that successfully battled Bill Clinton during the 1990s. Well, how successful were they, ladies and gentlemen? He stayed in office. Yeah, he was impeached. And I find that's an interesting thing that the media doesn't bother to tell you anymore. Isn't it fascinating how, I mean, every single time anybody says the word Bill Clinton, the words Bill Clinton, they should say, put impeached, former impeached president Bill Clinton. That's the way it should be. Because that's the way the media was trying to villainize somebody, that's exactly what they would do. Former impeached president Bill Clinton. This is the way it should be, because this guy should have that hanging over his head the rest of his life. He was impeached. But oh, that would reflect badly upon Hillary, wouldn't it? But after he was impeached, he wasn't prosecuted, so he stayed in office. Anyway, they say they tapped former Democrat Senate aide Melanie Sloan to run the new organization. Sloan built the group into a major player in the progressive movement, filing numerous charges against George W. Bush and the Republicans in Congress. In 2015, she yielded control of Crew to another former Democratic aide, Noah Bookbinder. Now, so they go on to talk, you know, list some of the, you know, the founders being wealthy Democrats. Norman Eisen, he's an attorney and former partner with the law firm Zuckerman Spader. After serving as deputy general counsel to Barack Obama's transition team in 2008, he was appointed special advisor to the president for ethics and then ambassador to the Czech Republic. He's donated $58,250 to Democratic causes since 1999 and bundled between $200,000 and $500,000 for Obama in 2008. Louis Mayberg is co-founder and current president of ProFunds Advisors, LLC, prominent mutual fund management firm. So here's the thing, folks. When Democrats are demonizing the rich, folks, do you think they're going to kill their own sources of funding? Think about it. How much do you hear, oh, let's make the rich pay their fair share? What do you think that means when they're the ones that are rich? They are rich. They're funding by billionaires, millionaires, investment bankers. Give me a break. Anyway, he's a donor to the Democratic Party. Mayberg has donated at least $25,850 to Democrats and to Independent Senator Joe Lieberman, who is not really that independent at all, is he? There's Daniel Berger, who's on the founding director. He's one of the founding directors. Still sits on the board of directors. Philadelphia lawyer, deep-pocketed donor. Donates to thousands of Democratic causes. So in other words, there's another one that's an advisor, has been an advisor to Hillary. Served as Bill Clinton's pollster for most of his presidency. That's Mark Penn. So are these people very likely to be balanced in their look at ethics and responsibility in Washington, D.C.? It's highly doubtful, but it's even more highly doubtful when you consider who's funding this group. Crew's principal source of funding, according to this Crew Exposed, is ideological liberal left-wing foundations. And guess who's at the top of the list, ladies and gentlemen? That's right. It's Open Society. The foundation to promote open society controlled by liberal billionaire financier George Soros and his family. He gave $740,000 since 2010 to the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Second on the list. Oh, look here. It's the Open Society Institute. Another George Soros outfit. $150,000 in 2010. And then you got others that are donating as well. The Bohemian Foundation, which is controlled by Colorado Democratic donor Pat Stryker and her political operatives. $850,000 they donated since 2010. Then you've got another Colorado Democratic mega donor, Tim Gill, and his Gill Foundation apparently donated $608,615 since 2010. See, these are the watchdogs on your responsibility and ethics, ladies and gentlemen. So, my point is, and it goes on, there's the Dyson Foundation, they're liberals. There's the Stephen M. Silberstein Foundation. Silberstein was a Democracy Alliance financier, tied in with UC Berkeley's Public Policy School. There is the Marcilla Foundation. There is the Leland Fikes Foundation. But they're all pro-Democrat, pro-liberal, you know. Anyway, the point is that you're not going to get any objective exposés out of this organization. But this is the organization that is apparently behind all of this Trump University. It's Soros and his clan. That's the bottom line. Big surprise, huh? Anyway, I think I'm going to leave that there in the interest. And one more thing. Yeah, I already mentioned this, but Soros is pushing for online voting. I got that story from Breitbart. We'll put that in the show notes later on when the broadcast is posted on the website. So anyway, since Hillary brought up the Trump Foundation, the question naturally came up on this flight about her own foundation. We'll get to that in a moment, but Hillary's vice president, Tim Kaine, was caught blatantly lying about whether the organization is currently accepting foreign donations.
On the question of the Clinton Foundation, I know they said they're not going to accept foreign donations if she's elected president, but if you've been to a wedding where they yell last call in 15 minutes, everyone rushes to the bar. Should we just get out in front of this right now and say not going to take any?
Well, I think it's now foreign donations as of now, and then as a president, President Clinton will step aside from his connection to the foundation. So she's taking one step forward right now. The foundation is taking one step forward right now by saying there's no corporations, no foreign connected contributions, not taking them right now. And then if we are successful and are elected, President Clinton will sever the tie with the foundation that he created.
That's not what Bill said.
I made it clear that if she becomes president, we'll have to do more than we did when she was Secretary of State, because if you make a mistake, there's always appeal to the White House if you're Secretary of State. If you're president, you can't. But we're going to transition all these responsibilities that would require foreign or corporate donations, which I won't accept, and I won't raise money for the foundation if she wins. And I'm happy to do the transition as quickly as we can.
Okay, so now that I listened to that again, they never said they would quit accepting foreign donations either. You know, they just said that they would spin them off to other organizations. That's what he just said there. And Chelsea, as we'll hear in a moment, just said something similar. They're going to spin them off to other organizations, which raises a whole new set of questions. Who's going to control those other organizations? And even if that was on the up and up, it's still not good enough, because the foundation is still free to accept bribes right up to Election Day. And then they have 4 or 8 years to make good on those promises. The Clinton Foundation should be shuttered immediately, ladies and gentlemen. But no, So the question then arises, what about Chelsea?
Can I ask you about, evidently you talked to ABC today about the foundation. You said it wasn't appropriate for your husband to be involved if you're elected. What about your daughter? Do you think it's appropriate for her to be still involved with the foundation? And does that raise some of the similar types of conflict of interest concerns?
Well, Laura, we'll reach that if I'm elected. But I just want to say how proud I am of the work the foundation has done. And it's world-renowned.
Uh-huh. And then she goes on to talk about the foundation. So she completely dodges the question, choosing instead to recite her PR spiel. Now, Chelsea confirmed the fact that she was staying on the board of directors, regardless of whether Hillary gets elected. She appeared on The View recently, and she addressed this. Of course, nobody bothers to press her on the ethics of running the organization, which is a funnel for her parents to accept bribes while they're in public office.
I want to ask you, there's been a lot of scrutiny about the Clinton Foundation in particular. Your father, President Bill Clinton, says if your mom is elected, that he will recuse himself from the board. You plan on staying on. A, do you think that's appropriate? Some might see that as a conflict of interest. And B, will you continue to fundraise for the foundation?
Well, thank you for giving me the chance to talk about the foundation. When my father left the White House more than 15 years ago, he knew he still wanted to make a difference in the world. And I'm really proud of so much of the work that the foundation has done. I've been thinking a lot about school recently because my daughter is starting nursery school. And here in New York City, kids went back to school earlier this week. And you can applaud for my daughter starting nursery school. Thank you. Yet, you know, on a serious note, you know, just a couple of examples of the foundation's work that are affecting school kids here and around the country. Every high school in America now has access to naloxone, which is the nasal spray that immediately reverses an opioid epidemic because of our work. Because no child should ever die of an overdose in our country. Mm-hmm. 18 million kids now are in schools that are healthier because of our partnership with the American Heart Association. They have healthier school lunches. They have more physical activity options in and out of the classroom. So we have to protect that work. We also know that changes have to be made. That's why we said all of our international programs, including our global health work that provides AIDS medicines to 11.5 million people around the world.
It's incredible.
The programs that support thousands of women entrepreneurs around the world, those will be spun off as independent entities or to partners. We won't accept foreign funding or corporate donations. My father will step down, and I'm committed to helping steward that transition because it is complicated.
So you'll stay on the board and you'll continue to fundraise?
Well, for now, I'll certainly stay on the board. I mean, we also employ about 2,000 people. Mm-hmm. We have a responsibility to the millions of people who are benefiting from our work. We also have a responsibility to our employees to ensure that they have jobs in the future. And then once we get through that transition period, we'll see what the right answer is for the foundation and for me.
Uh-huh. So we have a responsibility. You know, it's interesting. Chelsea's learning from the best. She's learning to be a world-class criminal just like her parents. So anyway, the next day, Hillary has a gaggle on her plane. And she opens up by calling Trump's question into integrity.
Start by referencing something that Donald Trump told ABC News. He said that the American people don't care about his tax returns. And in fact, he's also said that it's none of our business. I just think he's dead wrong. I mean, the reason that presidential candidates, going back decades, have released their tax returns is because the American people want to know. If they're going to entrust a president with the management of our country's finances, they want to know, how did this person handle his or her own finances, which is, you know, one of the reasons why...
First of all, it's not the president's job to manage our country's finances. That would be Congress.
Released 40 years of tax returns. And it's especially important given what we are discovering, not from Trump himself, but from the kind of work that many of you are doing and your outlets are doing. What have we learned? We've learned that Donald Trump has been bankrupted in his company 6 times. He's been sued about 4,000 times. He's been accused repeatedly of fraudulent behavior.
And you haven't?
His so-called Trump University is under investigation right now because of the way it has scammed so many.
Because of your financier, George Soros.
Students who thought they'd get a better opportunity in life. And we've recently learned that his Trump Foundation has been fined for illegal activity when it...
That's enough of that. I can't take any more. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, she can go on and on about the Trump University, but here's the thing. Hillary has her own university problem. There is an organization, matter of fact, Washington Examiner says, while there has been much focus on Trump University and the lawsuit against it, very little has been written about Laureate Education and its ties to the Clintons. Laureate is a for-profit online college that received an unusually large amount of money from the U.S. State Department. This happened while Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State and after her husband, Bill, was named honorary chancellor, a position that paid him $16.5 million over 5 years. His role included giving speeches around the world and lending his name to attract prospective students. Bloomberg reported in April that during the time when Bill was acting as a well-paid honorary chancellor, the U.S. State Department under Secretary Clinton gave a whopping $55 million in grants to the International Youth Foundation, a nonprofit chaired by Laureate's chairman, Douglas Becker. In 2010, the group received 14 grants worth $15.1 million. In 2011, 13 grants added up to $14.6 million. Bloomberg authors Joshua Green and Jennifer Epstein reported. The following year, those numbers jumped. IYF received 21 grants worth $25.5 million, including a direct grant from the State Department. Laureate itself was added to the State Department's Global Partnership Program, Peter Schweitzer reported back in his 2015 book, Clinton Cash, and now there's a documentary on that as well. So, once again, complete and utter hypocrite, and I think that's all I'm going to play. There's something I want to get in here before the show is over, and as usual, I'm struggling with the time. I don't know if you folks were aware of this or not, but we have a problem here with, you know, of course, the Bundys are in jail, and the jail that they're attending, I just found out, they're actually abusing. They've beaten Ryan Bundy. And I wanted to give this account before the show got over. I guess I'll start here with his wife. I think her name is Angie. Her and Gavin Syme did a little interview together on YouTube, and I want to share this with you because I think this is very important. We need to watch this and keep an eye out for this.
Hey, guys, it's Gavin, and Angie just got a call from Ryan from the jail. All the calls and the pressure at least got us that, and so she's going to give you an update on what happened today and what's going on down there at the jail that we know so far. So, okay, you are on.
Well, he's coming out with a written statement, and it will be way more accurate because I've been frantic all day. He did read it to me, and I will give you kind of the basics. He was woke up at 5:30. He was told he had court. So he said, I'm not on the docket. I didn't know about court. So he said, well, you go find out what it's about. It was a woman deputy. So she said, sure. So she came back, or a male came back, and Ryan's got his name on the affidavit. So he asked about what's this court about? You just need to come with me, kind of a thing. And so he's like, I want to put it out there right now. I did not resist arrest. All I did was inquire, because last week I met with, you know, government attorneys. They're wanting to do surgery. I'm resisting that for obvious reasons. I at least want some of my demands met before they do that. And this was all hush hush, secret. You know, first thing in the morning, it looked suspicious, and so I was just asking. They went downstairs to ask. In the meantime, he went back upstairs to visit with Ammon for just a second, and he's like, on the way back down the stairs, the sheriff's deputy took me by the nape of the neck and tried to throw me down the staircase. And he's like, I grabbed onto the railings, and he goes, by when all was said and done, I had three guys just beating me up. He goes, I didn't I didn't, he's like, I was going with them, I was complying. He's like, I kept saying I'm coming, like there was no reason for all of the assault, but for whatever reason, they felt the need to assault him. He made it clear that, he goes, this was about the bullet, that's what the whole thing was about. He goes, I don't know what they were wanting to do, if they were wanting to just whisk me into surgery or what, but he's like, I'm not complying. And so now they beat him up, and so now he's in solitary confinement.
So he's being punished now in solitary where he can't call his family, he can't do his case
properly.
Right,
I mean, his case
is... Because they beat him up.
Right, right. So it makes a lot of sense.
So the bullet is... They did not take the bullet off then, just to confirm that.
No, he's not going along with that.
Right, because we need that evidence.
Right, so I think that's part of the problem. He's not...
Okay, so I'm going to cut it off there in the interest of time. But that's... I think it's very important because now they're working this guy over... Now, keep in mind, Ryan Bundy is the one that was shot when they were in the car, and evidently he's had this bullet in his arm the whole time. I can't imagine, you know, what kind of an infection could be setting in or what sort of thing. And they're trying to remove the bullet because they don't want that bullet being presented in court. He did nothing to get shot, and yet, so the thought is that the officials are wanting to force surgery on him to remove the bullet so that it can't be used in court. Here's Ammon Bundy's account. He was actually in the jail at the time Ryan was being beaten and witnessed the whole thing.
Morning, I woke up to pounding on the door on my cell. It was Ryan at 6 a.m. He quickly told me that they were trying to transport him to force him to have surgery to take the bullet out of his arm. He also slipped me a note under the door that said they were taking him to Oregon State University Hospital to have surgery forced on him. The guard would not let him use the phone to call the attorney. He was calm but firm that they do not have consent to take the bullet out of his arm to have surgery on him. He told the guard that he did not know about any of this, and neither did his legal team. Nothing was on the court docket, no orders were made, nobody knew anything about it. The guard called in a sergeant, Sanders, and he told Ryan that the marshals were ready to transport him. I only briefly heard this. Then Ryan ran upstairs again to tell me that the marshals were here to take him, but they did not have his consent. The sergeant ran up the stairs after him, and then Ryan walked calmly back down the stairs. The sergeant began pushing Ryan violently and slammed him against the wall. Ryan was calm and non-aggressive. He said over and over again, I am going, I am consenting, I am going. The sergeant then slammed him into the sally port door and violently shoved him through it. Ryan was continually saying, I am going, I am complying, I am going. The sergeant then grabbed him by the body and swung him around and rammed Ryan's head into the metal door jamb. I heard a grunt from Ryan, but he kept saying, I am going, I am going, I am complying. The sergeant then slammed Ryan to the floor on his face. After a few grunts, he continued to say, I am going, I am complying, I am going. Shortly after, three or four men came in the sally port and forcefully handcuffed Ryan and dragged him out. I could not see Ryan's face where he was slammed into the metal door jamb. Ryan has never refused to go to court before, or anything else for that matter. He was afraid and had every reason to believe that they were going to force him to surgery. Just a few days before, the Department of Justice, I believe it was Department of Justice, had a hearing and was trying to get the courts to force Ryan to surgery. They already forced him to x-ray, and one doctor refused to do the surgery. He was informed that another doctor said he would do it. This bullet is one of the bullets that was shot by the FBI or Oregon State Police when LaVoie was killed. Ryan said he was shot in the arm before LaVoie left the vehicle. Ryan believes that the FBI were going for his head, and when it hit the glass, it deflected to his shoulder. The bullet is one that is unaccounted for and part of the FBI shooting cover-up. He also knows that another shot came through the roof that the FBI did not report.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there, folks, because we're out of time. I got the numbers for the jail and the sheriff and the judge, and I will put those in the show notes. I encourage you to call and let them know that everyone is watching. So I'm concerned that these people may end up dead if this kind of stuff continues. We got to go. We're out of time. God bless you. We'll talk to you next week.